From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. Well, a lot of people in this area are closely following new developments in the case of Aaron Swartz. You'll remember he's the internet activist who killed himself earlier this year after federal prosecutors had accused him of using MIT's network to download thousands of scholarly articles. His big issue was he thinks everything should be available for free. Meanwhile, his friends and family believe he was absolutely driven to death to kill himself by a justice system that just was hounding him needlessly over this crime, with a crime with no real victims. The person who has received the bulk of the criticism is U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz. Now, Carmen Ortiz is facing a congressional probe. Here to talk about this latest development is Boston Herald reporter John Zaremba. On the line is attorney, writer, and civil liberties advocate Harvey Silverglate. Welcome to all of you. So how did this come about, John, the actual congressional probe? Was it because the family pressed for it, or would Congress have done this anyway?
I think Congress might have done this anyway. You know, as Swartz's death was a big story and stoked a lot of outrage right away. And some members of this committee that's requesting the hearing have been sort of quietly looking into this, and now the volume is turning up a little bit on that. This is Daryl Issa from California, yeah, who is he's a big technology guy. He's a Southern California millionaire who made a lot of his money in computers, and he is the head of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. So last week they sent a letter to the Department of Justice with some very pointed questions,
yeah,
about how Carmen Ortiz
handled
this case.
Why was he charged? That's
exactly.
One, I mean, that's the first question they ask. Why was Aaron Swartz charged at all? And then they want to know, why did they pump up these indictments? There was an original July 2011 indictment, and then another one that came in September of last year, which added on, which could have added millions of dollars in fines and 10-year years in prison.
It broke up what they thought he did into individual offenses, and that in turn increased the potential penalties and really put a lot of pressure on Aaron Swartz.
You know, who was outraged by this in the first place? And I said, was it MIT professors who were afraid they weren't going to get their $12.50 for an article that nobody wants to read in the first place? I mean, who was outraged?
It's funny you mentioned that. The subscription service that owned the articles decided not to, and this is part of the letter, and they decided not to press charges against Swartz.
So
Ortiz's office went, they went forward with the prosecution anyway.
Were professors upset, though? I mean, who was upset?
That's hard to say. I think that's a good question for Carmen Ortiz to, mm-hmm, to see who was exactly upset by that.
Well, Harvey Silverglate, I know where you stand on this because you think the federal government often overreaches, and in this case in particular, you've written about that. But what do you think this congressional probe means? Is it going to have any kind of satisfactory ending?
Well, I doubt it'll have a satisfactory ending. I think it's actually just the beginning of a massive reaction by members of the Congress against some of the prosecutorial practices of the Department of Justice. And to tell you the truth, they could have really started this much earlier in connection with some prosecutions of members of Congress, but it wouldn't have looked good. It would have looked like they were just worried about themselves rather than the state of the law. So this is really a high-profile, very sympathetic case for the defendant, not a terribly sympathetic case for the U.S. Attorney's Office or the Department of Justice. It was like Congress was really waiting for a case like this because more and more of them are upset over the abusive prosecutorial use of some of the statutes that Congress, after all, passed. Congress is not without blame.
Yeah, I mean, because they wouldn't have gone – in defense of the U.S. Attorney's Office. I mean, they claim they have to do this. That's their job. That if this is in violation of the law, which they claim it is, they can't ignore it. They can't just turn away, right?
Well, first of all, It is really controversial whether or not what Aaron Swartz is alleged to have done and apparently did do was a violation of this statute. When you have doubt about it, and believe me, there is doubt, there are two very rational sides to argue this. You don't bring a criminal case. You bring a civil case. By bringing the civil case for money damages, you test the statute. Instead, what they did was, instead of testing it, they used such a blunderbuss that they were trying to get this kid to plead guilty so they wouldn't have a trial, so they wouldn't have an appeal, so they wouldn't have a test of the statute. And it was these strong-arm taxes that offended so many of us and apparently offended some members of Congress.
Yeah, because, John, one of the questions that Congress is asking, too, is about plea deals. Do we know that they offered him a plea deal, or they tried to?
That's been out there. I mean, what's been out there is they offered him, I believe, 7 to 8 months in federal prison if he pleaded guilty under, you know, certain circumstances. He clearly didn't want to spend any time in jail for this and didn't want to, when he got out, live the rest of his life as a felon. Given his past, I don't know that would have affected him. I don't think he would have any problem finding employment. But that's just not something he wanted to do, and it's not something that he thought he should have done.
Remember, this kid had a serious case of ulcerative colitis. He would not have really had an easy time in prison, even for 7 or 8 months. He had a very serious case of it, and it's extraordinarily painful and difficult.
And he also apparently had some other issues, depression and...
Yeah, I mean, the notion of putting a kid like this, and he's a kid, remember, he was in his early 20s.
26.
26. To me, that's really a kid.
Yeah,
the notion of putting him in prison, or if you want to teach him a lesson, it's very easy to teach a lesson, without giving him a debilitating felony conviction. You know, this is one of our best and brightest. Why in the world would any sane society want to have this kid disabled by a felony
And
condition?
It was basically a prank, right?
It was not basically. It was a prank. In a long tradition of pranks at MIT and even at more straight-laced Harvard, long tradition of these things, and yet Ortiz's office simply had no judgment. Now, again, Congress is partly at fault. They hand these vague statutes to irresponsible prosecutors, and then what do they expect? Surprise, they abused the statute because they did what we've enabled them to do by wording these statutes in such a vague and broad way.
By the way, do you feel the same way about the Bradley Manning case? He's been held now for several. He was the one who downloaded all that military stuff and leaked it to Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and all that. Do you feel the same way about him?
I think that Manning probably is more arguably guilty of a relatively clear interpretation of statute. So while I think that Manning's case is an example of vast over-prosecution by the feds, they're treating him as if he was, you know, Mata Hari during World War II. But I think it's a vast overreach. And in a way, I have to say, Manning was a leaker who actually did a public service. I'm very sympathetic to Manning, even if I think he probably is fairly subject to prosecution. That still is a very different case from Aaron Swartz, who, in my view, did not commit a crime at all and was being bludgeoned by the threat of a 7-year prison sentence unless he pleaded guilty. They didn't want a trial. They didn't want a test of the statute.
Have you actually talked, John, to Carmen Ortiz about this directly?
I haven't spoken to her directly. I mean, we did bring this up with her, and this was brought up with her at press conferences. There was a press conference a couple of weeks ago on another case where she was visibly very emotional. She was breaking down into tears a little bit, and it's clear that she's bothered by the death of this, you know, of this young man.
Because you wonder. I mean, she's a human being too. You wonder if she doesn't have some second thoughts about this and think, now that I look at this, this was an overreach.
Well, if she doesn't have second thoughts, there's something very wrong with her as a human being. I do believe that she is very upset by this. I think she probably had second thoughts, but I have to say, after her second thoughts, she still defended what her office did.
Yeah.
What her office did, if you look at the details, is actually indefensible. But to the feds, this is business. The indefensible has become business as usual. Over-indicting, indicting and threatening with such draconian penalties that they managed to wring a plea out of people who might well win their cases if they felt they could afford to go to trial.
Mm. I know you feel that way also about the Sal DeMasi case, and that case is actually back in court today as we speak sometime today. I can't say I read that entire piece yesterday, and maybe you two can explain it to me, but what the new angle is, you know, based on this Skilling ruling, and I can't quite follow it.
It's actually not a new angle. I wrote about it in my book, Three Felonies a Day, mm-hmm. which came out a couple years ago, and it's not really a new angle. What Sal DeMasi did is not very pleasant for many of us. But whether it's a federal felony is up for argument. I actually don't think what he did is a federal felony. Do I think it should be a felony? I think it probably should be. It's a conflict of interest and should be a felony, at least the state law. But it isn't. And what he did, it was not a crime at the time he did it. But because the federal honest services statute is so vague and so broad, they can actually make a federal case of it. And I think that's very unfair.
Yeah, but they're referring it to as bribery, which, you know.
Well, it isn't bribery.
That wasn't, yeah.
It's a conflict of interest.
Yeah, exactly.
And under state law, this could be made a felony. Under federal law, it could be made a felony. It hasn't been. And the legislature is rife with these kinds of conflicting practices. We want to clean it up. We have to have clear rules.
I think the Federal Appeals Court is going to disagree with you, Harvey. What do you think, John?
Well, the problem with the Federal Appeals Court is they've been enabling these prosecutions for so many decades that to them it seems clear. But to people out here who look at it more objectively, it's not clear at all. So the Federal Appeals Court's opinion, in my view, you know, with that and a dollar and a quarter, you could buy a cup of coffee.
What's your take on that?
I mean, I'm not going anywhere near DeMasi today.
No, no. Oh, because?
I got my hands full with this.
Oh, you do. Well, I mean, one of the things that they're talking about in the DeMasi case is this whether or not there was, you know, some kind of a formal agreement. Am I right about this, Harvey? That his attorneys are arguing that there was no handshake or formal agreement that they were going to, you know, take this money, you know, set it aside, a knowing conflict of interest. That's what they're arguing.
Well, that there was no deal between them, that it was sort of business as usual. And the question is, if you want to outlaw business as usual, you have to say so precisely because it's so usual. And if you want to change the culture of the legislature, you have to have clear rules because it's been the culture for decades. You know, we have a one-party state. We have a one-party legislature. It's been one party for so long that there really are not sufficient checks and balances. We have a political problem in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has to solve it by enacting new rules and clear rules. The federal government isn't going to solve anything because there's still no definitions of what's legal and what's illegal. Mm.
Well, going back to the Aaron Swartz case here for a minute, John, I mean, let's say this congressional committee, through discovery or something, establishes that this was an overreach. I mean, what's to be gained from it? What could the family possibly get out of there? Are they going to, you know, remunerate them? What are they going to do?
I don't know that the family would get anything from it. I think for the committee, I think politically this is very popular because politically Carmen Ortiz's prosecution of Aaron Swartz was very politically unpopular. And I think for them to put her on, you know, in the hot seat and to put her on C-SPAN and to stand up there and taking up this very popular cause, a very populist cause too, and say you overreached and you are you abuse your for them to say that she abused her office, I think is a political winner for them.
Yeah, I think the family has two interests here. One of them is to make sure that Carmen Ortiz doesn't launch or advance a political career on, you know, the life of their son. I can see them feeling that way. I think I would feel that way if I were in their shoes. That's number one. And number two, I think they're interested in institutional change so that federal law is clarified so this doesn't happen to another kid. So I think there are two interests here. There's personal and there's institutional.
I can't see the Carmen Ortiz thinking that this is any way is going to launch a political career for her. Do you, John?
Well,
I
think she thought so in the beginning. I think that's why they fought the case. They have been prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office have been launching careers in either politics or in, getting out of the U.S. Attorney's Office and getting million-dollar-plus starting salaries in big law firms for decades. And maybe now we're going to get to the point where they're not going to advance themselves by abusive prosecutions.
All right. Interesting case. We'll be following it. Harvey Silverglate, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And here in the studio, John Zaremba. Thanks, John, from the Boston Herald. Appreciate it. And Kara Miller's back. What do you got? All things Lincoln, I understand.
Yeah, exactly. We're looking at Abraham Lincoln as a model not just for presidents and politicians, but for business leaders. In this season of, as you said, everything Lincoln, what can we learn from it?
Yeah, I wonder if the movie was really real to life. You'd like to think so, but...
Yeah, it certainly Daniel Day-Lewis seemed like he was channeling Lincoln there.
We've had presidents like that now. All right, I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio.